Cheers,
ladies and gentlemen.
Cheers.
During his middle period, he was moving away from programmatic music, which is music that tells a story. He was writing absolute music, where the music speaks for itself. And he was moving away from folk songs, which I thought was interesting, because a lot of famous symphonies have origins in folk songs. Cheers.
Cheers.
Welcome to Pour Me a Mozart. I'm Asia, and I'm here today with Ari, and we are drinking to Mahler 6 and Hammerheart's, I don't know how to pronounce this, Loily? It's a sati, which is a kind of ale. So, hi, Ari. Thank you for being on the podcast. Very excited to have you here because you are the first percussionist to be on the podcast. Yes. So I'm excited to hear what someone in a totally different world from a string player has to say about this.
Hey, I'm over here in the back.
So you were working really hard on this before we got started. Mm. Are you ready?
Yes.
2 minute history of Ari. Ready, go.
Born and raised in Lauderdale, Minnesota. Grew up in a musical home as a youngest child. My dad came to Minnesota to play in the cello section in the orchestra. My mom started me on piano at age 5, started percussion lessons for band in 5th grade. My love for Chopin and anything I remember or drum set just grew and grew, but wanted to pursue becoming a doctor. I started my college career as pre-med at St. Olaf College and graduated as a music performance major. And then I was injured for playing too much. Took me 3 years of physical therapy to finally practice enough to audition for grad school. Went to Boston Conservatory. Met more people that played marimba, which is an instrument I now primarily play. I moved back since then and been freelancing with various music jobs and gigs. I perform and teach percussion and piano through St. Olaf College, my own studio, City Strings and Piano, and my social music. I'm an orchestra librarian and administrator. I'm a founding member of 10th Wave Chamber Music Collective, which is a chamber music group that features music from the last 100 years or so, and we try to perform in concert halls and breweries and cafes to make cool new classical music accessible to the common people. Work for the Minnesota Orchestra as a library researcher. I spent several summers at Breckenridge in Colorado for their orchestra library, National Repertory Orchestra, and I'm now social distancing but still trying to teach virtually through my new series Mini Music Break, which is a 15-minute piano lesson or music lesson for adults that want to get back to playing.
Wow, that was like a minute and 20.
Oh,
nicely done.
Yes. Did anybody understand any of that?
I understood it, so I hope everyone else did too. I didn't know you went to school for pre-med. What caused that change?
I realized that I was in the lab a lot and something wasn't right. And I would just go home to the practice room, go home to the marimba or the drum set or the timpani, you know, just the places where everybody else is. And it just felt like a community.
Cool. So it like, it really called to you.
Mm-hmm.
I thought you would probably mention this in your history, but I also wanted to ask about all these different hats that you wear as a musician. Well, first off, let's talk about 10th Wave, because I didn't know what a chamber music collective was until 10th Wave started doing stuff. So just explain a little bit more about what 10th Wave is.
Sure. Yeah. 10th Wave just started out with myself and two other friends, Bjorn and Whaley Grenache, the three of us, and then Ashley Ng joined later. But so the four of us now put together a bunch of projects that feature music that is composed in the last 100 years. And a lot of classical chamber music is composed in, 1700s or a little later, maybe. Mm-hmm. But after 1930, 1940 or so, it starts to kind of dwindle of the kinds of pieces that you'll hear from classical ensembles. And it kind of has to happen for percussionists because people haven't really written for chamber music for percussion very much.
Yeah.
Until the, 30s or 40s or 50s. Maybe
ragtime.
Which
is crazy because percussion is one of the oldest instruments.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or instrument families.
Yes. And there's definitely other... so when I say classical, it's just Western European classical music. And it's notated and it's in the Western European tonal system. So as non-pitched instruments, they don't really have a place. And for artistry, it's more about adding something to an existing melody.
Little paprika.
Just like making it sparkle. And there are a lot of pieces now, and a lot of composers are finding so many more cool ways to make sound happen. happen. Mm-hmm. And percussion is one of the cool ways to do that. But anyway, a 10th wave is a chamber music group. So it's all classical instruments like violin, flute, cello, piano, percussion, clarinet, and voice, and then some. We're a collective, so we don't want to limit our ensemble members because of who's available. It's more about what kind of pieces we want to play. Mm-hmm. And so it's called a Pierrot ensemble, which is I call it a junk drawer ensemble, where you just find one of each thing, and then you got a toolkit.
Yeah, and yeah. I really admire what you guys have done. You've really developed a following of not just like friends that go to your things, but you have people who love what you do. And I think it's so cool that you've been able to build that.
Thank you.
So another hat that you wear is working in the Minnesota Orchestra Library. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize there were library jobs for an orchestra, but you know, of course there are. Maybe what's other than realizing that there is a library for an orchestra, maybe what's something else that might surprise people about an orchestra library?
If you're a librarian for an orchestra, you're dealing with all the music, right? Mm-hmm. And that means that you're going to work with all the management and the artistic directors to figure out the publisher and the renter, and in addition to the programming. So what are you going to play for this concert? How much is the music going to cost? And being able to speak in business terms. And then you get to the library, you get all the music, and then the musicians are, they say, oh, wait, this passage, can you help make this page turn work? Wait, or to the percussion section, oh, this notation, or this is written really poorly. Can you restaff these?
You have to rewrite music?
Sometimes you do.
Wow.
In a professional setting, it's so far in advance that the composer is generally open to doing it themselves. When the budget is smaller, the librarian has to do more work. It can include just completely rewriting the music or transposing parts, making sure that it works for the instrument. And so you have to know both lines. And so the library is the first line between the musicians on stage and the administrators and the management off stage.
I wouldn't have never thought of your job as being like the middleman in
that
way.
It's pretty cool.
So speaking of the library job, you mm-hmm. work with our friend Patty mm-hmm. part-time in the library.
That's how we met.
Yeah.
She's pretty awesome.
She is pretty awesome. And she's been on the podcast, yes. My podcast several times. Now she has her own podcast, mm-hmm. Yay, Hayden Patty. Behind the Music Stand. Hayden, like the composer, is it?
H-A-Y-D-N.
Yes, thank you. I was going to try to say his first name, but I couldn't remember.
Joseph?
Thank you.
Joe Hayden. Joe Hayden, everyone.
Joe Hayden under
Joe
the
Hayden
table.
Joe Hayden behind the music stand.
But you were also just on her podcast, mm-hmm. which will actually air on Wednesday. We're recording on a Monday. Your episode of Hayden Behind the Music Stand is coming out on Wednesday. And then this episode is coming out on Friday.
People will be so sick of my voice. Oh my gosh.
No, they won't. It's the week of Airy. That's what I'm calling it.
Yay.
So if you're listening to this episode and you haven't listened to Patty's podcast at all, I highly recommend Hayden Behind the Music Stand. Your episode will be her fourth episode, I think. So it's a brand new baby podcast, but she's doing mm-hmm. such a wonderful job with it. And
So much fun to talk to her.
Yes. No spoilers, but she discusses things outside of music that inspire musicians or other interests that we have. And so I don't know what you talked about. Mm. I don't want to mm-hmm. know mm-hmm. until I listen to it. But you can also get a more in-depth history of Airy.
Yes. It's great to see her explore the other side of things. I think we have so much to share about music, but yeah, there's a lot to share besides that.
Yeah, we're complete humans. We're not just...
Are we? Asia, are we?
I would like to think so. But I mean, I guess...
Yeah, I think so too.
That's a topic for a whole different podcast. So on that note, what is your favorite snack?
For what occasion?
Oh,
like deserted island, like the same thing for the rest of my life snack, or...
Just like... Okay, what are you craving right now if you were to have a snack? Okay, what flavor?
Ben and Jerry's, the Americone.
Oh, is that the Stephen Colbert one?
Yeah, just good ice cream.
Also, Ben and Jerry's with their anti-racism statement.
So good.
Yes. Yeah, I'm actually not a huge ice cream fan, but after I read that, I was like, I do want me some Ben and Jerry's right now.
Yeah, they're doing great. And making sure they're keeping up with communicating with people. That's right.
What is your go-to drink for any occasion?
For any occasion. I think any like amber ale
I like the craft beers, otherwise bold reds like Cab. Yeah, beers and red wines are my go-to.
Yeah, there's so many good breweries. So speaking of...
so many.
We are drinking a Hammerheart beer, which
Thank
is...
Thank you, Hammerheart.
Yes, which is actually a brewery from my hometown, or in my hometown of Lino Lakes. So I heard about... Could I have said that more Minnesotan? Lino Lakes.
Lino Lakes.
They opened in 2013 after an internship at Norway's... Oh, man, there are so many Scandinavian words in here, and I am, like, all Scandinavian, and I'm going to butcher these.
Do they have the crossed O's and the...
The crossed O's. This one has two A's right in a row. They had an internship at Norway's Handbryggeriet in 2011. The face I made doesn't translate in podcast land, but I was embarrassed. And 2 years of life change that resulted in a production facility and taproom in Lino Lakes, Minnesota. The brewery's name was chosen from the epic Viking metal album Hammerheart by the classic Swedish metal band Bathory. I should know how to do this better. This is my own heritage. This album combined two sources of endless inspiration for us, metal and mythology. We have spent 6 years exploring beers rooted in tradition, honoring friends, family, and other important things in our lives. With over 130 recipes and counting, many rarely seen outside of Scandinavia. I was panicking about the next word. Such as Stordalsal. STJ O R D A L S O L. Finnish style Sati, Sahti, which is what we're drinking. Or a... This one is terrifying. JUL capital crossed O. Maybe that's a typo. I have no idea. L.
Okay.
Jewel.
It says Jewel.
Sure. Aged in aquavit barrels.
Sorry.
I have absolutely no idea. These are things we have committed to and things that give us purpose. So I thought that was really cool. You know, considering it's also my heritage and my hometown, even though I can't pronounce any of the words I just had to say.
It's okay.
I also couldn't figure out how to say the name of this beer. It's L-O, the two dots are an umlaut, right? Mm-hmm. Y-L-Y, literally?
Y-L-Y.
On untapped.com, a bunch of reviews. People love this beer. And then Dan S. wrote a review. Hammerheart is such a sleeper brewery. In an age of smoothie sours, pastry stouts, and triple IPAs, they make older style brews that stand up to and in some instances outshine the competition. Mm. This one is earthy, smoky, and just fun to drink. And I would absolutely agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like it. It's easy to drink and it cuts well. Yeah, the aftertaste is clean and refreshing. So
yeah.
Good job, Hammerheart.
Yeah, good job, Hammerheart. But I chose this because we chose Mahler's Sixth Symphony specifically for the Mahler Hammer, which is a percussion thing that, Ari, would you like to talk about?
Well, the Mahler Hammer is a nickname for basically a large 5 feet by 5 foot wooden box and climb on a little ladder or stool and you hit the top of the box with a hammer. So Gustav Mahler called for... So he says, okay, I want this many piccolo, flutes, clarinet, you know, so on and so on. String section, brass. And then in the percussion section, he asks for a hammer in addition to the timpani, the glockenspiel bells, the gong, the snare drum, and cymbals and whatnot. So the hammer description that he says is a short blow, powerful, but dull in resonance with a non-metallic character, like an axe. So basically
like an axe.
A huge thud. If you look up Mahler 6 Hammer, there are several YouTubes and GIFs that show how people do it.
Isn't there that one really famous video where, because percussion is right behind the horn section oftentimes.
Oh my gosh, I feel so bad.
And there's one where, like, didn't the French horn player, like, jump out of their seat?
Yeah,
in that moment?
There's some, that was loud type of face, you know?
Yeah. So I also wanted to ask what it's like to be a percussionist, because there are just some aspects to it that are different than other orchestral instruments. So can you share a couple of those things?
Well, being in an orchestra section, a percussion section, you are a soloist no matter what, because No one else plays the instrument. So even though you're percussion section, that just means you happen to be together because you happen to hit stuff. So whatever you're hitting, you're a percussionist. The teamwork comes in blending with each other's sounds, even though you're all soloists. So you'll have someone has an anvil, someone has a huge drum, someone has a ratchet or a bird whistle or they have
a triangle. You know,
yeah, it's just everything, mm-hmm. which is fun.
Yeah, and that's another thing too, is like you get to play so many instruments.
Oh, it's a playground. The percussionist, I think you have to learn how to be in the music without playing. In a hour and 20 minute piece like this one, you see a lot of measures of rest. So you just sit there and listen until it's that one part where you play that one note. So I call it professional listening, because you get paid to listen to cool music that your friends are playing. And then you just happen to come in right when your instrument is gonna play. You play your note and you sit back down. So
I forgot about this, but there was a church gig I used to do and you'd get paid like, I don't know, $300 for like a couple services. And I heard that there was one person they hired to play only bass drum, mm-hmm. and I think he had to hit the thing like 3 times. Mm. And so every time he hit it, he was like, $100. There's $200. Then his last one, made my $300.
There's a great meme that's it's three squares. The first one says, and there's a person with a crash symbol, and it says, "You missed your note, panic." Second one. It was only one note. Oh, okay, that's fine. Third note. It was your only note. Panic. It goes to show how important those moments are mm-hmm. for the percussion.
It's not just practicing. It's sometimes building your instrument or like constructing a set.
Yeah. I've been that person in the metal area at Home Depot with a mallet.
I'm just hitting things
and trying to figure out which which combination of light switch protectors do I need to play this piece, and etc. So
yeah, there could be a whole podcast about weird things percussionists do at Home Depot, I'm sure. I think we talked about this when we were planning the recording, but which Mahler symphonies have you played?
Oh, I've only played the first one 3 times.
3 times. I think I've played the first one either 2 or 3 times. I can't remember. I think it's the most frequently programmed.
Yes.
Yeah, but neither of us have played 6.
Mm-mm. I've seen it.
No. I hadn't heard it even before getting started for this podcast, just because I personally find Mahler really hard to digest. Mm-hmm. And I'm getting better at it. Like listening to this one, I was like, oh, I was also cleaning, but, and I think it's maybe something that comes with age, but it was easier for me to listen to than like, for example, we did Mahler 4 one year in school. And I remember being like, okay, I'm always told, listen to your pieces before the first rehearsal. Mm-hmm. And I just like, it was so overwhelming and they're so long too. So shall we talk a little bit about Mahler?
Yeah.
So Ari and I have both played his first symphony multiple times. And I actually have an episode. It's episode 10 in season 1 about his first symphony, the Titan Symphony, where you can hear maybe a little bit more background about him. Or maybe I'm doing more background now because I was reading this on Wikipedia and all of it sounded foreign to me. So he was born July 7th, which is tomorrow.
Woo!
Happy birthday, Mahler!
Ma.
1860, and he died May 18th, 1911. He was born in Bohemia to Jewish parents of humble origins. He displayed musical gifts at a young age and graduated from the Vienna Conservatory at age 18 and found success as a conductor in many different posts, kind of like advancing his career, so each post is more important. And finally, at age 37, he was the director of the Vienna Court Opera, which is where he gained most of his renown as a conductor. While he was alive, very well known as a conductor. But I didn't know this. His compositions didn't get a lot of attention until after his death when they were rediscovered in 1945.
And then more in the 70s. After World War II, his fame came back. Yeah, but
he just needed a world. Oof, I haven't even... Oh, it's the tequila I had before.
It's the tequila. Yeah. Yeah, the bourbon's kicking in.
Great. So this is Symphony number 6. sometimes called the Tragic Symphony. It was written in 1903 and 1904, and then revised in 1906. It premiered May 27th, 1906. This comes from Mahler's middle period, when he also wrote his 5th and 7th symphonies and the Kindertotenlieder. And some would argue that his 8th symphony is part of the middle period. Some would argue that it's a period on its own. At least that's what I read on Wikipedia. During his middle period, he was moving away from programmatic music, which is music that tells a story. So if you've listened to episode 1 of this podcast, which was about Hector Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique, that's like the most clear programmatic music you can find outside of like a ballet or an opera. But he was writing absolute music, where the music speaks for itself. And he was moving away from folk songs, which I thought was interesting, because a lot of, like, many famous symphonies have origins in folk songs. So the symphony is in A minor. It has 4 movements, and as Ari mentioned earlier, it's about an hour and 20 minutes long, because he... he is not succinct.
No.
The first movement is about 22 minutes long. We'll start with the first theme. This is not the very beginning of the movement, but I wanted to feature the full orchestra. So Patty and I, when we do the podcast, we're like headbanging and dancing, but the percussionist over here is just like point when the big thing happens.
I'm in halftime feel for most of it.
I believe it, yeah. So this to me sounded very typical Mahler. It's the kind of wild string passages.
Have fun. Yeah. See you on the other side.
Yes. I really like this. It has a march feel, and the very opening of the movement has a snare drum also, which is very much like a militant march.
Yeah, again, it's absolute. Can't tell a story, don't tell a story. Can't. Don't make it program. Don't add things to it. But yeah. You can't stop. You can't help but sense that there's an urgency. The strings know it in their own way.
Their own very special way. All right, so let's hear the second theme.
And again, it's not supposed to be programmatic, but Alma, Mahler's wife, would say that that's her. Because Mahler, when he was composing this, he told her, I tried to get you in my piece, and I hope you'll be happy with it. So,
I mean, it's beautiful.
Very sentimental. Some people think it's satire. But yeah, this part is, it's after the development. So in a typical 4-movement symphony, it's typical... sonata form. Have you talked about sonata?
A little bit, but you can explain it again.
For any conventional classical symphony, the first movement out of 4 movements is going to be in sonata form, which means there's a theme or two, and then it changes, and then the theme comes back in the key, whereas in the beginning. So Mahler followed this structure when he composed this.
So he wrote a beautiful theme for his wife. Maybe or maybe not.
Maybe or maybe not, right. And apparently after the premiere of this piece too, Mahler was upset in his green room because he was scared that he just used too many instruments for it.
That's like his thing.
I know, right?
What up, bro? Like,
and he's always up about his rival, Richard Strauss, who, you know, during that time, Strauss would get it on the first try, and Mahler did not. So Mahler was always insecure about it. So,
oh, poor buddy. Yeah.
Poor buddy.
Well, I love them both equally. Though Strauss is shorter and more easy to take in.
Yeah, which is why people program him so much more, because Mahler's too long.
So Mahler really toyed around with which movement he was going to put where of the second and third movements. And I guess in the book I read, The Symphony by Preston Stedman, it said that he settled on the slow movement being the second movement. But The recording that I have put the scherzo as the second movement. And when Ari and I were talking about this, you mentioned it's about 50-50 what orchestras do. Some of them play the slow movement second, some of them play the scherzo second. Mm-hmm. So, which is kind of a weird thing because I don't really know of any other piece that does that. Here, we have this... I can words. We have the scherzo second, and I'll play the opening for you. So there you get more typical Mahler, like the da, 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 da. That's very Mahler. And then there's the, sighing horns. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh, the do do do. Maybe that's more like braying donkeys and not sighing.
But, I think I did read somewhere that it is, well, as absolute as it is, I keep saying this, but the scholars are saying that the donkeys are critics.
Oh, interesting.
And, yeah. And so, yeah, you're right about the donkeys. But nice. Again,
yay, donkeys.
A program, not a program.
Yes.
don't give it meaning.
And then I also mentioned the Mahler Tech tone colors when we listened to this beforehand. And Ari, your response was, oh, overplayed winds, which is kind of true. It's kind of like blow your brains out. Not like with a gun, but like blow through your face so that your brains come out your ears.
Several times he does call on the score to get your bells up. Mm-hmm. So, you think of clarinet, you're angling your horn up toward the audience.
Oh, what else was I going to say about this?
Sounds just like the first movement?
Yes. And that's why Mahler wasn't sure if he wanted to put it as the second movement.
And it's cool because in the first part, you really do see a lot of the elements from the first movement. So if you're listening to this, you can look for the same kind of instruments, the same kind of texture that's coming from the first movement into the third, in the scherzo.
My cat just laid over all my notes.
Game over.
Podcast done. So the scherzo is the shortest movement at 12 minutes, and a scherzo is also accompanied by a trio section. So let's hear the beginning of the trio.
It's a part of the movement.
So the brass coming in at the end is another typical Mahler thing, and it's almost like a conversation.
Like Mahler 1.
It does sound like Mahler 1.
Yeah, actually. The end of the first movement.
Yep. I remember what I was going to say about the other excerpt. Mahler uses dynamics in a different way than many composers, or at least many composers I had experienced by the time I played Mahler for the first time, where like, it's not everyone is playing at the same dynamic level, mm-hmm. which creates... I think really cool textures.
Oh yeah, it's like surround sound.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the very quick changes when you are playing dynamics as an entire orchestral organism. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like it's loud and then suddenly very soft and mm-hmm. it's just like constantly like we're over here, now we're over here, now we're over here. It's mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, I think that is so great. And sometimes conductors do choose where say like the string section. You sometimes see all the violins in the first two rows. Sometimes you see them on all of them on the left side of the stage. So like placing the instruments in different places changes your surround sound experience mm-hmm. of the concert hall. So
yes,
but in this case, there's just so many instruments.
It kind of doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter, but at the same time, you can have a lot of variety.
Mm-hmm. Did I already say the scherzo is the shortest movement?
Yeah.
12 minutes.
The trio part is actually, I think it's 3-8-4-8.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
It's a mixed meter. So it's not just 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. It's like 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4. And you can kind of listen back to it and just count 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4. And so on. Mm-hmm. And that it just lopsides it.
Is it always 3, 4, 3, 4? Or is it sometimes like in mixed meter, it'll be 3, 4, 4, 3? No. Wait,
what? So
I'm thinking more Stravinsky will do that. Like if he wants something in 7, he won't always make it the same pattern of 7.
Oh, yeah. This is just all manually in it. So if he wants 3, if he wants 2, 3 beat measures in a row, then he'll just write that in instead of putting a pattern of, oh, it's always going to be 3, 4, 4, 4. Or 3, 8, 4, 8, right? So 3 little beats, 4 little beats.
Okay.
Because sometimes there are doubles of 3 little beats, 3 little beats.
Okay, yeah, so, that was what I was wondering.
Yeah, yeah. So,
which throws it off kilter even more, because you get lulled into this pattern of 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4. But then when it's 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, I can't even do it. It's clear, I'm not the percussionist.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1.
Yeah, it's like, where's
it's
that
like, when is 4 coming in? Mm-hmm. And so it's always a surprise, and that kind of throws you off, and that's the point.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a really playful and fun thing that Mahler's putting in there.
Yeah, I like when that happens. Mm-hmm. So moving on to the third movement, the slow movement, or depending on the performance, might be the second movement.
Might be the second one.
It's a
gamble.
Choose
your own adventure.
Choose your own adventure. This one, interestingly, brings back memories of other pieces. So I heard Debussy's Clair de Lune at the very beginning, and then Ravel's Pavane for a Dead Princess at the end.
Mm-hmm. Very impressionistic.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, up with the times of the time that he was composing this. A lot of higher tertian chords, is what they call it, right?
And Clair de Lune was written in 1890, published in 1905, which was before the premiere of this piece, and then Ravel's Pavane for a Dead Princess was written in 1899. And was he influenced by this? Could have been. Could have come up with it independently. Who knows?
Yeah, but they were all around the same time, so.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if they knew of each other's work.
Mm-hmm. But I was listening to this while cleaning, and I was like, this is no longer Mahler. Like, what's happening?
Actually, I have moments like that, but I say, this is no longer Mahler, this is Star Wars.
Yes. That too.
It's no longer Mahler, it's Alan Menken. Anyway, yeah, so this part is, you can find connections with his Kindertotenlieder with this part, the folk songs. And the Frederick Rückert poems that have to do with his grief after his children passing. Those are the poems that he set to music, or Mahler set to music, and now it's kind of incorporated in here.
Even though it's not about anything.
Again, absolute music.
Yeah, I think that's just so hard to achieve.
Yeah, especially in this type of, if you think Strauss or Mahler,
yeah.
Generally you want to, and everybody around them wants to, think that it's it has to do with some life event.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk about the hammer blows. But people want to just prescribe stuff to it and think that, oh, well, this has to do with his life outside of music. And does it? Well, he's dead, so we don't know. But
that's true.
We can talk about it.
I do remember in high school, I had an intro to lit class, and we were discussing the crap out of these books. And finally, someone was just like, do you think this was the author's intent, or were they just writing? And it's like, you can get, I think, overly scholarly about stuff.
Yeah, easily.
Yeah. And it's like, does it matter? Do you like it? Yes or no?
Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's all about if you're going to meet the person and ask them, that's probably the best way to figure it out. Probably the only way to figure it out. Regardless of all the reasons why you're right, you might be wrong.
That's true. Well, but I wonder if even the composer would know, because aren't there things that you've done that, like, if someone were to ask you, like, the next day, you'd be like, oh, did you do this because of that? You'd be like, no. But if you reflect on it, like, 5 years later, you're like, oh, yeah, I totally did. Mm-hmm. Like, you might not know your own intent or inspiration.
I think that's what Alma Mahler's, his wife, is basing her arguments on, is that she knows what he's talking about. Mm-hmm. And she knows because she's his wife, you know, his late wife by the time she was talking about him, like, you know, 40 years later, is she
wouldn't be his intent. Late wife. She would be his widow.
Oh, right.
Because that would mean she died.
She died. Sorry.
I was like, wait a second.
I'm a ghost, Alma. Sorry.
I love it.
But anyway, scholars argue against Alma's feedback and her comments. And I don't like that either.
Yeah.
Because it's like, who are you to say that? She is she is the widow, you know? She knows him much better than you do.
Than a scholar who was born, like, years after he died.
Yeah. I mean, why are you arguing with that, right? And
yeah.
It's like, oh, but the music. And no, you're just being machismo. Like, you're just being like, well, women shouldn't be composing. And
well, look at my brain.
Well, I mean, that's what happened with Alma, too. Like, she couldn't compose, right? She agreed not to compose so that she could take care of his kids while he composed.
Oof.
Yeah. So.
I'm glad things have moved forward since then and, you know, they're plotty ways. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. But I'm glad that Alma had time to talk about, like, his work and lift it up in a way that no one else could ever do.
Yeah. So, I'd much more take her word for it than some scholar now. So this last bit from, actually, the last three samples from the symphony are all about percussion. But this next clip I wrote, what the percussion?
It's the cows!
Yes.
Product placement of Kemp's dairy farms.
No, Ben and Jerry's. I thought we were supporting Ben and Jerry's. Yes. By the way, if you would like to sponsor the podcast, Ben and Jerry's, you can email me at twincitiesymphony@gmail.com. So I picked the excerpts, and when Ari got here, she asked, did you pick the part with the cowbells? And I was like, I don't know.
Of course you did.
Yeah, of course I did. But I didn't know that those were cowbells. And the other thing that just occurred to me is it sounds like, well, Ari was also like shaking the bells in the air. She's playing air cowbell along with the recording. But it sounds kind of random to me. Mm-hmm. Is it supposed to be
notated?
That way?
Mm-mm. It's one note with a zigzag on top of it. And that goes, it keeps going until you stop in the music.
Oh.
That's literally how it's notated.
Are there bar lines or is it just like?
There are bar lines to follow the conductor, right?
Okay.
But the zigzags tell you when to go and the zigzags stop, you stop.
Interesting.
So you can do whatever you want. But from what we know of Mahler and his love for cowbells and how they show up in a bunch of his symphonies.
I didn't know this.
It's just to, from what we know, it's a reminiscing of nature in the Alps and the cows. The low bell is like the master milk source or...
What?
Milk. No, the one that gives the most milk. Anyway. Something... I don't know about herding cowbells, but... The lowest one is like the queen cow that like gives the most milk.
Queen cow
is what I've read. Oh man. Anyway, so it's supposed to sound like you're frolicking in the
in the meadows and of the Alps, and it's just this glorious nature. And you can hear again the music too.
You can, yeah. And even though this music is just for the sake of music.
Yeah, again, absolute. No cows here. Just pieces of metal. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so his use of cowbell is everywhere where it seems like his ideal state of bliss and happiness. So this is a part in the slow movement that shows a moment where he's really, you know,
one with the cows.
Just one with the cows. One with the world.
Great. All right. We've finally reached the point where we get to share the Mahler hammer.
Yay!
Should we just play it?
Yeah. Goes. Hammer blow number one.
Hammer blow number one. So actually, will you talk a little bit about how many hammer blows there may or may not be?
Got it. Yes. So this blow, it happens like 12 minutes into the finale. The piece is just called, or the movement is just called finale. So.
Sorry, if you heard that little exclamation, my cat just almost destroyed this entire podcast by walking onto my laptop. So, minor cat interruption, but continue.
Yes, so it's far into it, and there's just a lot of ups and downs and crazy just flipping, turning around and everything. And then all
did
of
you
a sudden,
say just flipping, turning around?
Yeah, flipping and turning around.
Oh, flipping. Okay. I thought you meant it like...
Like flipping and turning around and everything. It just twisting and turning, I guess. Mahler in his just stay busy and strings, keep playing all your little notes. And then it accumulates to this moment. And there are actually several of these moments where, which is why I think they used to have other hammer blows in them. So Mahler originally had 5 blows written in. And then he revised it to have 3. At his premiere, he had 3, and then he crossed the last one out. So there's actually 2. Yeah, the first hammer happens, like halfway in.
Wait, why did he cross out the third one?
He crossed out the third one at the end because people think, again, he didn't directly say why, but people think he crossed it out because he was superstitious about the actual meaning of these hammer blows. And he was...
Wait, what is the actual meaning?
So, what people think is that, the hammers were starting to depict some kind of weird omen for him. And, like, he was, kind of sealing fate for himself, in a way. He's, putting himself into a trap of,
the Nine Symphony trap?
Yeah, these. I don't think it's going to directly affect the Ninth Symphony curse. Whatever the Ninth.
Mm-hmm. Which we talk about more in depth in episode 10.
Oh, okay. yeah, so this is just in general.
Just him being people, superstitious.
He's just being superstitious. So like, oh, shoot, like 3 bad things are going to happen, and it's because I wrote this symphony, is what people think. And it's weird because Alma would say, well, it these... this piece happened before all the bad things happened to him. Like, this piece was written at at the height of his career.
But why this one specifically? Is it because it was number 6?
Well, the other ones didn't have these moments, right?
The hammer moments? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm not connecting all these dots that he seems to be connecting.
Yeah, he's...
Did he have a psychotic break or something?
So, everything bad that happened in consecutive order, like just like bam, bam, bam. Those all happened after he wrote this piece, which is why people think that he determined these bad things to happen for himself by composing this piece. So it's kind of like a telling the future kind of thing. And people usually say, nah, he just wrote it.
I mean, that's kind of the camp I'm in, even though I like to believe in, like, other weird stuff.
And I think that that's the safer way to
see
it. Yeah, yeah. I mean, why not? Like, it happened way before, and you don't just curse yourself by composing symphonic works, right?
Well, and also, I was thinking about this unrelated to the podcast today, but the Yoda quote of always in motion, the future is. Like, you can't know.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and I mean, Mahler never claimed to know the future. So,
I guess.
Like, I mean, people say that because they can see it from afterward.
That's true.
Right.
Hindsight is 2020.
Yeah. Hindsight is 2020. I finally get that. Yep. So the three hammer blows, people attribute those three moments to three different events that happened in his life after he wrote this piece.
Okay.
And the first one is the illness and death of his first child, Maria, who died when she was 4. And she died of diphtheria and scarlet fever combination. Alma also got sick, but she recovered. Yep. And then the second blow is diagnosis of his fatal heart condition. Mm. And then that eventually is the reason why he dies. And the third one is the forced resignation from the Vienna Court Opera.
Mm-hmm.
So, because right at this time he's their conductor, right?
Yeah.
And because he got married and he just wants to sit and compose, he's out at his villa a ton and he's conducting less and less. And all those obligations he's just throwing off to the staff at the Vienna Opera. And at that villa is where his daughter passes away. Huh. And it's just a big moment. All these, like, those three things happen and people are, you know, just so, they just want to program it, you know, they want to match those blows in life to the hammer blows that happen.
Interesting.
Which is weird, but yeah, I mean, as intensely as people make four compositions like this, and it's so epic, right? And it's so overwhelming, and you just, like, you just get taken over by this this kind of huge work and get swallowed up by it. So if life throws you around like that, then I guess it can look like a hammer blow in your life.
I suppose. But, like, does taking out the third hammer blow only mean that two bad things will happen? Like, why not just take them out entirely if that's what you're thinking?
Right, yeah. He probably didn't take it as seriously at that point.
He must have taken it seriously enough, though,
to take out the last one.
Yeah,
right? Because the last one would be the final blow, right? The third one would be worse than the first two.
Okay,
but who knows?
Not on the same page as Mr. Mahler, but you know what? That's fine.
We don't even know if that's the reason why he threw it out.
Yeah, that's true.
It might have been a completely, you know, composer musical, like,
it's too many.
It doesn't work. Yeah, too many. Just two is fine.
Well, shall we hear the second blow?
Yes.
Thank you.
like.
I know. And when you're like, I hear Star Wars, like, that's a moment where you can hear, like, it's battle music. For sure. Not that we're putting a story to it, but
no story.
It's battle music.
Stop the story.
Yeah. I really like, you mentioned that in this recording, you can't really feel the blow as much as in the YouTube video that you were watching. By the way, did you want to mention which orchestra you were listening to?
Oh, I mean, there's plenty on the Berlin Phil. Yep, there's a couple on YouTube that aren't bad. There's a Bernstein one that's also
That's the fun. One I listened to on Spotify with Berlin
mm-hmm.
Phil.
Mm-hmm. Amazon Music has Solti and CSO.
CSO is...
Chicago.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
I couldn't letters.
I couldn't letters. And that one has more than two blows, so you can look for those.
Oh, sounds. Okay.
The thing is, with this recording that we're listening to for this podcast, it doesn't really...
You can't you don't really feel it quite it. As much. Mm-hmm. But what I do like about the orchestration is that as the blow happens, you get a really high note in the flutes, which is kind of like... If you think about a hammer striking, like you might see in like mythology with Zeus creating lightning bolts or something, it's maybe like that spark that comes off because you hit it like a little too hard. I don't know. I think the orchestration there is just brilliant.
Mm. There are other instruments that play at the same time.
Yeah.
So it's a mix of sounds for sure.
Which is another thing that Mahler does so brilliantly is mix mm-hmm. instruments to get just this really cool sound.
Bass drum, cymbal, orchestra, hammer. Yes. I just need a big, big thud. Just a...
Big thud, lots of sound. Yeah.
Perfect. I love his ideas.
Do you have anything else to say about this piece in particular?
I just want to make sure that his daughter died after this composition was made, which I think is true. Because from what I read... From what I remember, people are baffled or, you know, they're wondering if Mahler was actually able to predict this fate of his daughter. The irony in that is the slow movement is about Rückert's poem mm-hmm. that is about his children's death.
Yes.
So.
Oh, that is interesting.
That is so creepy.
It is creepy.
Yeah. There are a lot of scholarly articles and such that kind of dwell on that fact of mm-hmm. Weird things happening when you compose weird stuff. And there's one person that does say that argues that Alma is the hero. Again, not a program. Huh. And you know, her theme in the first movement and her grief and her hammer blows, I guess. Does she have the hammer?
Oh,
that'd be cruel.
Yeah, who has the hammer? Comment on Instagram and Facebook.
It would be awesome to see a female percussionist play the hammer part.
Oh, it's I suppose not usually.
You know how often there are female percussionists happen, like at all in orchestra? It's a very male-dominated section.
I guess I hadn't really thought about it because the percussionists that I know the best are all women.
Mm-hmm. The hammer blow is such a central point. Right? You're mm-hmm. in the finale and there's so much chaos happening and then you see one person just slowly get up from their chair in the back and they grab the hammer.
Do they have to do it slowly? Is that written in the part?
No, you don't want to run to it though.
Why?
Right. But you're the only one playing it. Well, you don't want to miss a hammer blow. Come on.
So what if you like took a... Never mind.
You're not going to choreograph to that point of like, run! Pow! That's going to look like you forgot where you were.
I guess when you...
Oh, shoot! I got to pick up the hammer and throw it!
Yeah, when you just chuck it at the thing. Literally throw the hammer.
Oh my gosh, can I see a catapult version of this hammer blow?
Poof! You know, Ari, someday when you play this with orchestra... You get to build your own catapult, too, I'm sure.
Oh, my goodness.
What a dream.
What a dream. If I had that much money and no one would say anything about it.
Yeah, can you imagine like, just, like, building a catapult in your apartment?
It's like a target on the wall. Okay, anyway.
So, Mahler has a very famous quote that I'm going to paraphrase, that a symphony should encompass the world. I asked you before we started recording to mm-hmm. think of how would you describe Mahler in one sentence? And I have my own. Do you want to go first or do you want me to go first?
Sure. It's really technical. Okay, here goes. Mahler is the enigma and culmination of Western European romantic symphonic music and the long-winded grandpa of film music that has some awesome stories.
The long-winded grandpa. I love that.
I mean, yeah. He has the same stories, and they're really long, but they're really amazing.
True. Yeah. I dig it.
Yeah.
Mine's much less technical.
Good.
Mine was a journey through space.
It is. It is a journey. And space is big.
As I was listening to the symphony, I was thinking of, like, the original Star Trek and, like, how the Enterprise is, like, whoosh, do, 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 do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope I don't get a copyright lawsuit over singing that. But, like, traveling from planet to planet and, like, seeing all these different worlds. And
yeah. It's way beyond what we see every day here.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate that he goes to the depths of that. And
yeah,
there was a time when people really raved over this stuff.
I mean, people still do.
People do. I'm glad that we can spend time to appreciate, like, it just works with time, you know? You don't have to get everything instantly anymore. You can wait for things because of COVID.
Yes.
And you don't need all of those, like, you know, extreme blissful moments or all of those in an instant. So that's why you appreciate Grandpa.
Yes, and his long-winded stories.
Mm-hmm.
Well, shall we cheers to Grandpa Mahler?
Grandpa Mahler!
Cheers!
Cheers!
Oh, wait! I have, like, a whole closing spiel I'm supposed to do.
Okay, sorry.
And also, I need to thank you again for being on the podcast and for doing the research and for contributing to our Mahler conversation.
Yeah, so it's fun.
So yes, thank you, Ari, for being here. And also, if you would like to continue to support the podcast, you can listen to other episodes. I think a lot of listeners tune in for, like, one episode or two because they're interested in the piece or they know the guest. I encourage you to listen to other episodes. I mean, I'm biased, but I like all my guests and I like all the pieces. But another way to support the podcast is to follow at Pour Me a Mozart on Instagram and Facebook. If you would like to support the podcast with some money, you can support it at patreon.com/pourmeamozart for $3 a month or more if you choose. There are going to be some cocktail education videos coming soon to Patreon members. So thank you to the 3 Patreon members right now.
Woo.
Who are on there. Yeah. Woohoo. 3 members. You will be actually getting some content soon.
Yay.
Also, by the way, I posted about the podcast on my personal Instagram at Violining Asia last week, and you'll never guess who saw my Instagram story that day. Seal.
Whoa.
I know.
What?
I saw him at the bottom and I was like, this can't be the real Seal. But I looked and it was his verified account. So Seal listens to this podcast apparently.
Mm.
So hi. If you would like to be a guest, I would love to have you. Send me a message. Otherwise, be like Seal. Look at the story.
Yeah, everybody.
Yeah.
Be like Seal.
That's, yeah. Okay, now we can cheers.
Sweet.
Cheers to Grandpa Mahler and Seal.
Cheers to Grandpa Mahler and Seal. Sorry, what were we talking about? I just looked at your cat.
Cats are distracting.